Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios, East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is the Halloween episode 151 of Registry Matters. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Oh, I love that sound effect.
How about that? Oh, people in chat are already saying they're scared.
Where did that come from?
If I told you, then we would end up with a copyright infringement and we would get a takedown order.
Okie dokie.
What do we have going on tonight, Larry?
Well, we have some almost late-breaking news from Georgia. From the Peach State.
Okay. Peach State, eh? Is it peachy news?
Well, it's not as optimistic as, it's not as fantastic as we would hope for. And we've got some listener questions from inside, behind the walls, and from outside. And I think we might have a story or two. And, okay. And then someone wrote to us with a suggestion of how to get the podcast better distributed. And since I don't understand it, you're going to explain that.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. Is this evening a special night by any chance for the PFRs of the United States?
Depends on what state they're in. I think it's Halloween across the country at the time we're recording. But some of our states and our supervising authorities take a very limited view of Halloween in terms of what a person's allowed to do. And in my state, they require them, if they're under supervision, to take off work, make arrangements to not work on this date to satisfy the stay-at-home order. And that really bugs me that they do that, because it's hard enough to find employment, particularly in COVID-19, and to say, I won't come to work on a Saturday, which in retail, I think right now the retail establishments where people work are booming. Box stores are just filled with people, and the grocery stores are filled with people. So it kind of bugs me that people are not allowed to work.
I went out to lunch, and I don't even think of Halloween as a thing, to be honest with you. And all the wait staff was wearing costumes. There was like an astronaut, and there was somebody dressed as Michael Jackson, and he was actually like dancing at tables. It was very entertaining.
So I didn't remember costumes being a big thing in Georgia back in my day, but it always has been here.
Don't you think that, I think I've heard you say something to the effect of, there might be something of a First Amendment challenge at Halloween for things like the costumes?
I believe there is. There's certainly the right for people to express themselves and to decorate. And that's one of our most cherished rights. And without any narrow tailoring, I believe that those type of restrictions would be extremely vulnerable to challenge, that you have to refrain. It comes back to having the financial resources to fight the government and having the legal team that's willing to be in a protracted battle we're going to be talking about tonight, one that's already a year old. And that's it's a short side of, they generally drag on for multi-years. But I think that would be something that would be vulnerable to challenge, to require everyone not to decorate. Maybe you could come up with some individualized circumstances for a particular offender where they would not be allowed to do that, but just across the board, that's real problematic.
So, and I guess what somebody has to do is like decorate their house and then let them come in and be on nasty about it and take you off to have somebody, you know, with skin in the game, having standing, I guess is the term.
That's correct. On the standing, you wouldn't necessarily have to risk arrest, because to have this requisite standing, there has to be a bona fide threat. So if you're given a directive that you cannot decorate, then you would have the requisite standing. You would not have to wait, because the certainty of arrest is almost imminent. If they tell you if you do these things, you're going to be arrested. The problem with that, waiting to that, they generally disseminate these directives a week or 10 days out for Halloween.
Correct.
And you don't get a lot of advance notice. So therefore, trying to gear up for a legal challenge is difficult, because if you file this year for what's going to happen next year, we get into the international Megan's Law situation. It's speculative. You have to opine to the judge that's hearing the case for your restraining order that you believe, based on prior practice, that they will be an order come down 10 days before Halloween that says you can't do these things. And that doesn't give you really time to gear up for a preliminary injunction hearing. And the states where it would be more easier to do that would be one like in Tennessee, where they have it in the statute. It's not a policy, but it's a statute. Okay. They have that 10 or 11 day period where you're not allowed to do things. There's no speculation at all, and that's on the books. And so if you are within the zone of the people covered by that statute, you would have the requisite standing, and you could file without waiting till they put the handcuffs on you. So I don't like to tell people to wait to be handcuffed. Being handcuffed is unpleasant, and all the consequences that go with that. But sometimes that is really the only reasonable alternative, is to be handcuffed. And then they're still going to argue, like if they were to handcuff you and take you to jail for violating the Halloween directive, they're going to argue, once you finally get before a judge, they're going to say, it's now moot because Halloween's over. We're ready to let him go.
I was wondering if, if you were so inclined and had the resources, do you go hire an attorney sometime in the summer to just spool everything up? And as soon as they come out with it, that you would have already your guns loaded, ready to fire, that you could, you know, shoot them down a week, 10 days in advance and run into the court system immediately?
Yes, that's what you do.
Okay. Good grief. So, and, you know, we're talking many thousands of dollars.
Many thousands of dollars, yes.
What about, my curfew this evening started at 5 p.m. and ends at 7 a.m. tomorrow. Is there anything there?
Again, with any order that has no narrow tailoring that intrudes on a fundamental right, there's vulnerability, because you have some fundamental rights that are enshrined in the Constitution. Are you being precluded from doing something that's fundamentally your right to do? Because clearly, supervised offenders can be restricted in their movements. That is a given. But if they have a blanket policy that tells every supervised offender you cannot move between these hours, and there's no exceptions for hardship or anything, then those factors weigh more in your favor. Because if they can't articulate a reason for you to be immobilized, do you have a curfew normally? Are you restricted to your domicile on normal days, or can you be out gallivanting the streets?
And is that, you're actually pointed to asking me that question?
Yes, I'm asking you that question. I don't know. Are you under any restrictions in terms of curfew? Because here, every person who is under a sex offender supervision, they already have a curfew. So this is nothing new.
This is nothing new, but this is an extended one. This is extra restriction. Mine is normally 9 p.m.
Until what time?
I go out and exercise. You know, it's supposed to be like 7 in the morning or something like that.
So, anything that intrudes in a fundamental right without any narrow tailoring is vulnerable. But I don't know that you have the gobs of money or would be in your interest to challenge that in view of the circumstances that you're in. And that's what a lot of people have to consider. They have to consider what the adverse ramifications would be. The money is the major barrier. But there are also other considerations.
We need a bunch of people to throw grenades and jump on them.
Now that's going to cause us to be banned because of that word. There's a big government listening device right now that just picked up on the grenade.
Yeah, no, but I didn't use the B word, the four letter B word.
So, well, the grenade's probably being tracked also.
I don't know. The grenade doesn't sound nearly that bad. You know, like horseshoes and hand grenades. But that other word, that. All right. Anywho. All right, we should move on. We have some questions that we're going to go over before we hit the featured event. Shall we dig into Robert's question in Georgia?
Let's do our best.
And so his question is, during sentencing, the public defender stopped the judge to have me sign the unsigned plea papers? Is that legal? Does it give me grounds for a habeas corpus? Even to me, Larry, just like, does have me sign the unsigned plea papers? When else would you sign them?
Oh, you could sign them at any point. The plea offer is usually extended to the I'm saying usually, it's not a given, but usually extended well in advance. The negotiations are going back and forth, and you may get multiple offers and counteroffers. And at the time that you and your client come to an agreement, that it could be signed before court. What he's referring to is what I'm guessing he does not write very clearly, nor does he communicate his key points very succinctly. So it forces us to have to guess. So I'm guessing what happened was that on the day he was hauled to court, he had not agreed to the plea, and the plea proceeding was taking place, and the judge had called the case, and he's saying that the attorney pressured him at that point. He doesn't use the word pressure, but he's implying that the attorney pressured him to sign it right then, and that's what he's wanting to know, if there's a habeas for that. And the answer is probably not, because even if he signed it, even if everything he described is exactly as I'm inferring from what he didn't say, if everything was exactly like that, the process requires an individual addressing of the person, the defendant, in open court, and all those questions they ask you, they're pretty standardized across the country because it's based on Supreme Court ruling, which I can't cite the case, but there's an individual admonishment of all these things to understand whether you're competent, whether your attorney has explained everything to you, and if you're satisfied with your attorney's representation. Yeah. And he, that would have been the time for him to have said no. Nobody does it, but that's the time for him to have said, well, Your Honor, actually, I don't like this plea agreement. I just got it today. I haven't had a chance to consider it. And my attorney has told me if I don't sign it, I'm going to go to prison for 200 years. But he didn't say that.
Correct.
He said yes, yes. He answered every question correctly to the judge's satisfaction. So therefore, the likelihood is very low, not impossible, but very low, he would be able to set aside that plea on a habeas corpus proceeding.
And real quick, what is habeas?
Well, it's nothing more than a vessel that's used, a legal process when you don't have anything else. When you've pled guilty or no contest, you don't have a lot of appeal options in terms of undoing it. So then the few remaining vessels you have is habeas corpus. You can say that it's a Latin term to bring the person before the court and justify their detention. So you use that vehicle to challenge your confinement, saying that I shouldn't be confined because this plea was not bona fide correct, because here's the things that render that plea invalid. Almost all of those are turned down because the process, all they'll do is look at the transcript and see that he answered yes, no to everything correctly. And as far as his incompetence, what people like to do, and I'm going off on a tangent here, what people like to do is they like to pretend like they're incompetent after they've done the plea.
Right.
They don't raise – you're presumed competent. That's one of the presumptions that goes with you when you're accused of a crime. Everybody's presumed competent. And unless some evidence surfaces to the contrary, that presumption stays with you through the duration of the proceeding. And what happens is during the plea process, they generally ask, are you under the influence of any medication or any drugs illegal that would render you incapable? Well, you're going to catch 22, because if you say, yes, I'm all doped up, that was a violation of your conditions of release if you were out on release. So they're going to lock you up for violating your conditions of release because you said, yes, I'm on illegal drugs. And if you say, no, I'm not under the influence of anything that would render me incapable, then you have the new problem, because you indicated that you were not. You were not incompetent. I've gotten letter after letter after letter through years. Well, I was high. I was this. I was on that. When I did the plea, I didn't understand it. You didn't tell the judge that. You told the judge you weren't.
I have to tell you from personal experience, the way that they did it here is you're in what would be the room be called where you're like signing those final paperwork? I mean, like here, it was right next, it was attached to the courtroom, and the courtroom is loud, or maybe it was all the other holding cells were right there and you're trying to sign this stuff. Anyway, it was loud. Yeah, it had to be right attached to the courtroom because like the court was telling us we were being too loud. I couldn't hear my attorney, and she's like, hey, you got to sign these 45 blocks, initial, and I'm in cuffs. It was it was a very distressing. It was not a happy situation.
Well, and you had the opportunity to tell the judge I wasn't able with handcuffs to review the documents I was signing. So therefore, I'm going to tell the court I really didn't know what I was signing. They would have suspended the proceedings, and the judge shouldn't have taken the plea. And the judge would have said, counselor, make sure your client understands what we're doing because I don't want this case to come back up on appeal. That's what would have happened.
Somehow seems like that would have gone poorly for me in the end.
I don't think so.
Maybe the DA then withdraws everything and starts ratcheting things up, making stuff worser.
Well, the DA shouldn't have done that. I can't say what the DA would have done. But it's imperative that you understand what you're doing. And that these are life-altering decisions. And if you don't understand something, when the judge asking you, did you understand it? If you didn't, the time to say is, no, I didn't. And nobody does that. I explained that to a federal judge when I went to a national defense lawyer's annual meeting in Philadelphia some years ago. He's now a circuit judge, but he was a district judge then. And he said that he makes sure that he goes the extra mile. He said, I make sure that I take the time with each individual defendant. And I said, well, he presented himself as being a great guy. And I said, well, is that you're doing that in the interest of making sure the defendant knows what they're doing, or are you interested in closing the door on habeas corpus? And he looked at me like he thought there was like, where's this guy come from? But as a judge, what do you expect the person to do when they're in this situation? When the person that they is their advocate, because they ask you one of the questions is, are you happy with your attorney? That would be like asking me when I was in foster care in front of my foster parents, are you happy with how this family has been treating you as a foster child? What or is a 12-year-old or 10-year-old kid going to say?
Yes.
And so I asked the judge that.
Yes, they're the best.
So I asked the judge that. What would you expect when your advocate is standing at your side? And you're asked, are you satisfied with the work that person's done? What would you expect the answer to be?
Sure.
And he acted like he mumbled something to the fact that he hadn't really thought about it from that perspective, but he said he doesn't know. And there is really no other alternative. You can't ex parte the defendant because that's not fair to the other side. So the judge doesn't get to go have a private conversation without any lawyers present and ask, are you satisfied? He has to do it in open court, he or she. Because judges are women also, but you can't exportate those. So it's a catch-22 for the judge.
All right, let's move over to the snarky question. It says, I'm disappointed after listening to Registry Matters episode 150. You two never seem to be positive on anything, even when there's a fantastic victory like the one in the Mississippi Supreme Court. Larry always seems to dash our hopes when he makes his predict. Isn't that from Louisiana, Larry, not Mississippi? Forgive me.
Did we have
the driver's license one? Okay, so let me back up then. Even when there's a fantastic victory like the one in Louisiana Supreme Court, Larry always seems to dash our hopes when he makes his predictions that they will simply do a new marking on the license. Isn't it just as likely that they will realize the error and let the issue die and fade away? A positive attitude will be great once in a while. You two are something else. I'm thinking in my head, he probably was saying, you people or something else.
So, well, other than the state being wrong, that's a good question. But I guess I can apologize, but I don't know what I can do about it. I apologize for coming across as negative, but I don't know what I can do about it because the likelihood of them just letting this issue die and fade away is very remote. And I say that based on the evidence we had in front of us. We had, based on the Supreme Court's research, we had a finding that Louisiana was one of only 9 states that marked driver's license in any way. And within those 9, they indicated that many of them were very discreetly done. They also opine that Louisiana's was the worst. I've never carried a Louisiana or any of the states marked driver's license, so I don't know which is the worst, but I'm taking their word for it because their analysis was that it was the most obnoxious marking in the nation. So I'm looking at the evidence we have and what we know, and then I'm looking at what we know about how systems operate and how this is a political decision that has to be made. The lawmakers are going to be confronted with the decision to just simply let the licenses be unmarked going forward, or they're going to be told by the law enforcement apparatus that clearly the court said we can do it as long as it's not as intrusive as it was being done previously. They said that, and the roadmap is there. So you would have to be an extremely optimistic person to believe that they would go from being the worst state in the country to just simply letting it fade away. Is it possible? Yes, it's remotely possible that they would do that. But I think it's so remote that if I were to say that I think this is going to be a fade away and be forgotten about, I think the listeners should abandon us altogether as being a reliable source of information, because I don't believe that to be what's going to happen. I believe they're going to try to mark the licenses again in some capacity. I don't know what they'll try to do yet, but I don't believe they'll let this just fade away. But I guess I can answer the question with a question. Do you want us to tell you what you'd like to hear when we analyze these things, or what we think's likely to be the trajectory of what's happening going forward?
I can tell you what Super Patron Mike usually says, like always says, is that he appreciates when we tell it to him straight, but he wouldn't want us to tell it to him any other way. He wouldn't want us to try and make it all happy sounding and this and that. You know, I mean, it is an excellent victory for those people, but that would, if you were playing a game of chess with someone and you made some incredible move to defend against their attack, they're not going to just go, "Ah, crap, they really defended well," and they lay down their queen and you win. They're probably going to make another play to push back against your defense. They're going to keep pushing.
That's my expectation. Now, if all of a sudden the people of Louisiana rise up by large numbers and say, "We find it appalling that we were putting scarlet letters on our driver's license. Now we know this. We demand that you don't enact any more laws to this effect." That could happen. Based on the years I've been in advocacy, I have not heard of a population rising up against anything that's done to PFRs. So that would be a first. But could it happen? I guess it's possible. It could happen.
Am I wrong in my assumption that it comes back to us if we turned around and told our legislators to not do those things, and then if they did, we would change who the legislator is and put somebody else in there that we have questioned to say, "Can you not do those things?" We have the power to change these things at the legislative level. Am I wrong in that assessment?
You're absolutely correct. But the public opinion...
A lot of people don't agree with that their votes matter.
The public opinion is going to be in favor of what they were doing. And the magic is to change public opinion. And that's not going to be an easy task, because it's kind of like a lot of the myths that people begin to believe. They've been out there for so long that people accept them as being true.
Right. Right. I was listening to a podcast and it was a very pro criminal justice reform episode that they had done, and they came to the issue of rapists, and they said that they are likely to get out of prison and immediately go find someone to rape. And I was like, I don't think that's how it works. A, for rape, you're going to be there for a really long time, most likely, and they're going to be heavily, heavily watching those individuals when they do get out. I just didn't see it, like their recidivism rate is going to be super high. You know, a drug person is going to end up with a pretty high recidivism rate compared to almost any of, quote unquote, our people. It seems vanishingly small.
It is, by every measurement that's been done. Within a particular type of category, though, the recidivism is a lot higher. The non-contact offenses tend to be higher recidivists.
Okay.
That's just the given. But the contact offenses, unless it's a serial individual, mm-hmm. the recidivism,
like an actual damaged, medically treated, like a person that needs counseling, like somebody that just makes a mistake kind of person, the urinating in public, which probably doesn't exist, whatever, but that kind of person doesn't need counseling and has a very low recidivism rate.
That is correct. And those impulse control ones are what you're talking about, where people make an impulsive decision. People have all sorts of impulse control issues. People are compulsive shoppers, and they bankrupt their families.
Right.
They're compulsive gamblers, and they bankrupt their families. And I'm not equating the significance of the two, but I'm saying impulse issues. You could have a sleepover of a niece or a nephew that has developed physically, and you could have had a drink or two, and mm-hmm. you could put your hands where you shouldn't because of a lack of impulse control. And after the system has done the harsh things they've done to you, you're never going to do that again.
I gotcha. And one more after this one. It says, this is a question for Larry. This came over from Discord. It says, Larry lives in Albuquerque, right? Has he ever talked about the pretty good-sized Copwatch movement that goes on there? There are at least three groups that frequently post videos to YouTube of police interactions. I gather that they use police scanners to find the locations and then record from a respectful distance. The Albuquerque Police Department seems to mostly leave them alone now. Seems like a great constitutional way to keep the police accountable. I wonder if Larry knows or has any thoughts about it. Might be an interesting topic for the podcast.
Well, it might be, except I don't know anything about it. I know that the police, due to litigation through the years and through the federal consent decree that we're under right now, that they have improved a lot of their protocols in terms of citizen oversight but as far as the organized groups, I didn't know anything about that. So this person has enlightened me to something that I'm not aware of.
If we can sort of pull back though, what is your opinion in general of all of the cell phones, all the cameras that everyone has running around that they capture, the George Floyd events and so many other things? Do you think that's positive, or is that a negative for the community and or the police?
Well, I think it's a positive for both the community and the police, because I believe that the police, by and large, want to do a good job. I have those rose-colored glasses that they want to do a good job, and I believe that there's systemic problems within the police bureaucracy that cause. I mean, watch the movie Serpico. I believe that was recorded in 1971 or 70, sometime 50 years ago, and I don't think a whole lot's changed since Serpico. I really don't. So I think that the cameras everywhere give us insight into what we would never have known because of the blue wall of silence, where it's just the code of conduct that most officers remain silent. Well, the videos speak volumes about what they're being silent about, and oftentimes they taint their reports with narratives that just don't match what actually happened. And we get a better accounting by the videos. The good police officers should be happy that these recordings are happening, because that prevents them from being put in the position where they have to rat on one of their colleagues. The ratting is done by the camera.
Okay, I see what you're saying there. That makes sense. Yeah, they don't have to be trapped up in some sort of being the snitch inside the organization. They can just let the public speak for it and so forth. Okay.
So I think it's a good thing, and I think that there's a lot of good police officers that are happy that it's happening. And I think there's some not so good police officers that try to confiscate video equipment and phones, and they do that and say, we're seizing this for evidence. But unfortunately, that's going to happen. I mean, they're still bad cops out there. They're only human beings. That's all.
Yeah. Right. Well, we can do this a little quick. Somebody wrote in that listened to the podcast. This came back fast, Larry. This is only from episode 149, where we discussed getting the podcast into the prison system. And just, further talking about that, this individual is referencing that he gets religious kind of podcast from a Jewish organization, an Orthodox Jewish organization that he is working with. And he provides us with some resources, and I assure you, I will check into them. But what I found from just a very intensive, like 30-second Google search, was that it was going to cost us money to get our product distributed into it, and not cheaply either. But I will certainly try to figure out how to get them published in. That would be super fun if we could get them actually published inside the prison.
Oh, it would be. Don't you think the prison administrators would be really fond of this program?
I have a feeling that they would object to it. But at the same time, if we did have that 501c3, which I know will work on either at the beginning of the year or after the election coming up, but I imagine that would help us.
So, well, there actually would be prisons that would object, but if they actually sit down and listen to what we say, I think a lot of prison administrators would be very happy with us because we try to call it down the middle. Yeah,
Yeah.
I have no hesitancy to criticize prisoners. I've done it over and over again about their internal code of conduct, about how they classify inmates themselves, and to who's the sleaze balls, and in terms about how they're willing to jettison their own due process. They don't want you to. They don't want to administer. They fight for their due process, but they don't afford anything to anybody else. They have their own administration of justice. It doesn't. I mean, I think the prison administration would really like us because I give them credit for the hard work they do. Running a prison is not an easy job. It is not.
But I'm thinking back to the Mississippi. I think it was Parchman is the prison that the riots broke out 6-ish months ago.
Yes,
Yeah, somewhere in
Parch.
that. No one could do anything but go, those are deplorable conditions. I can't imagine everyone going, well, that's what they deserve. I mean, I guess people were saying that's what they deserve. But, they're in there like animals. That's why they're in there. That's probably a common sentiment that people had. But they shouldn't have been treated that way in the first place. I don't know that anybody would really object to how that they are being treated incredibly harshly.
Well, but again, sometimes the prison administrators are stuck with that, not of their own choosing. You have prison administrators who want to do, they understand Correctional Association, ACA standards. They understand how a prison should be run in terms of classification and not running a snitch system. They understand all that, but they're not given the resources. When they go to their
Right.
legislature asking for resources about employee compensation, which is usually deplorable in most states, particularly in the South, and when they ask for funding, they're the lowest on the totem pole. So you have good administrators who are stuck with old, ancient facilities that are underfunded, and they are tasked with doing the best they can with what they have. And then you have horrible prison administrators who are like former Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who are excited to see how much misery they can inflict on people. Now, that's the type of prison administrator that would not like me because I would call that administrator out and say, you could do a whole lot better with the resources you have. But sometimes, like in these southern states, Alabama doesn't allocate very much for prisons, and they lock up too many people. And those people are stuck in a very bad situation trying to make the best of what they have.
And I will also say, Brian, thank you for writing to me directly. And also, thank you for having incredibly legible handwriting.
Oh, that was a fantastic letter.
Yes, it was.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
I think, Larry, that leads us to this final little tidbit on this Georgia thing, doesn't it?
Yeah, we're gonna spend some time talking about an important case.
Well, I think things started, if we do a little bit of history, the way that you wrote it up, it says on September 24th, a lawsuit was filed in the United States District Court of the Middle District of Georgia challenging the Butts County Sheriff's Office practice of placing warning signs at the residence of PFRs before Hallows Eve. And then we went to court. I was in the courtroom with another person from Georgia, and the judge like gave us the injunction. That way, I guess, yeah, that was just this last year. And that was an incredibly great victory that we had at that time that shut down that whole process. What transpired from there?
Well, what transpired from there is the injunction for people who may be joining us for the first time. An injunction is an order granting you relief that you have not won, because the case has not been tried on the merits underlying your complaint. You're asking for relief in advance of your case being adjudicated. And the standards are incredibly high to get an injunction. It's not anything to do with whether the judge likes you or dislikes you. It has to do with the four-prong test, which the two most important ones are you likely to succeed on the merits when the case goes to trial? And will you suffer irreparable harm if the injunction relief that you're requesting isn't granted? And those critical factors, those two, determine whether you're going to get injunctive relief or not. And in this particular case, the judge felt like that the evidence was there, that the likelihood for success on the merits were good, and that that the harm would be any First Amendment deprivation or infringement would be irreparable harm. So he granted injunctive relief, and then that put the kibosh on it for those plaintiffs. It was actually not a class action. It was only for the plaintiffs that were named, and the court encouraged them not to do the signs in general. And they didn't, but the injunction was really directly applied to the plaintiffs, and then the case had to move forward towards a trial, whether it was going to be a full blown trial or whether the case was going to be resolved by an agreement between the parties, or whether there was going to be a decision made without a trial through a process called summary judgment. And this case was decided in that last process that I mentioned by summary judgment.
Did the sheriff say anything? Did he perform any actions that really were like kind of egregious? I think there was things in the, what I'm actually getting at is that I think there were things in the case that were brought up that there was no intent to put these things out there to highlight PFRs, but there was stuff found on his Facebook page from the previous year of like, I'm going to like single these people out, something like that.
So, well, I'm not sure I follow that question. The intent becomes to whether you're litigating for damages under 1983 and you're which is a section of the United States Code, civil rights, you have to be able to show that there was a right clearly established and there's a willful intent to violate that right. And if you're getting at that part, the sheriff's department was claiming that they didn't intend to intrude on private property, that they thought they were on the public right of way. Is that where you're going?
No, I'm actually referring to, because he was posting on his Facebook page just about that his whole intent behind this was to, I don't want to say that he didn't use the word shame them, but the intent was to, you know, highlight and show everyone where these people were. That was the intent, but he didn't bring that forth as being quote unquote his intent. He was just trying to keep the community safe, Your Honor.
Well, but I do remember that he said he was simply trying to do his duty. He put his hand on the Bible, and he said that he felt he had a duty to notify the citizens of the presence of these people, and that he was doing that. That was his intent, nothing more.
But the post that he put on Facebook the year prior to is what I think kind of got him in trouble, is that there was that from the previous year, and that's what he was trying to do. And then everyone's like, oh, thank you, Sheriff, for keeping the people safe.
Did they say it like that?
In Butts County, they would definitely say it that way. Definitely they would say it that way.
Where is Butts County for our global audience? If you were to look at Georgia, where would you find Butts County?
If you were to find a place between Macon and Atlanta, it would be pretty much halfway between. There's the diagnostic center for the Georgia Department of Corrections. It's called Jackson State Prison, and it's right in that general vicinity. It's probably just a hair south of the middle point between Macon and Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty much Nowhereville, though.
So yeah, it's still a small county. I think somewhere around 20,000-25,000 people.
And what was Mr. Long's, what was Sheriff Long's attitude about where this was going to go, even if we won at the next level after that, you know, since the summary judgment, but, you know, he lost the injunction, if he had lost the case, what was his next step? What did he want to do next?
Well, he did. In fact, he filed an appeal on the injunctive relief, and that is pending, set for oral arguments in the 11th Circuit, which is in Atlanta, for mid-December, I think 15th or 16th, and he had taken that up on appeal. Injunctive relief is immediately appealable, because again, you're getting relief that you haven't won. And he filed an appeal, and the appeal has yet to be decided. We argued that the appeal was moot. Our team argued that the appeal was moot because the injunction was only good through Halloween 2019. Therefore, the court should not consider the appeal. Now, our posture may change, and I'm not prepared, nor am I in the total know what they might do next. But one of the things you would do next would be that since the case has been resolved on the merits, you would consider trying to get the court to take this, consolidate the injunction appeal with the appeal on the merits, and go ahead and have the oral arguments if you're ready on the whole case. But the more likelihood is they'll probably cancel that hearing, because now that the case has been resolved on the merits, there's no need for the injunction here, because the injunction is going to be lifted by the district judge who issued it. If it's not clear that it dissolved itself because it was only for 2019, if an order is requested, the judge is going to issue that order because he's found against us and in favor of the county.
And just forgive me for a minute, going back a couple questions from the listener saying that we're all negative Nancys all the time, that here is a direct example that we shot them down and got the injunction. The sheriff should have been like, whoa, okay, sorry, you guys are right, man. We're just going to back off. But that's not what he did. Granted, the Spalding sheriff did. And then we also sent a letter down, I don't remember the name of the county, down like in Mosquitoville of South Georgia. We sent a notice citing the injunction, and they backed off. So I'm just using that as evidence to say they may not just back down when you say, hey, you can't do this.
They're not likely to just back down. What people fail to realize is that the governmental entities have virtually an unlimited bank account. And there are a lot of attorneys out there that love to make money. Therefore, they have no difficulty finding attorneys to represent them. None whatsoever. Because they're going to get paid, generally at an hourly rate that's very attractive. And they're happy to run up billable hours. So they will invent arguments. They will invent stuff that you could never imagine, which if people want to bother to read this decision, they did some of that. But they will invent arguments to litigate, and they are going to do that. It doesn't matter if it's in the pristine, pure state of Maryland where they're wind-driven, or if it's in Arkansas, whether it's in New Mexico, whether it's in Georgia, doesn't matter, Michigan, that's what they're going to do. And if you are in denial that they're going to do that, then I can't help you. But that's what they're going to do. They have unlimited resources, and they're going to fight anytime you're challenging the constitutionality of anything that's a law. Now, this wasn't even a law. This was an action initiated without the benefit of law, and they still fought it. So it's a lot of wishful thinking to think these people are just going to go away.
We have a series of prepared questions, so I'm going to, between you and I, we created a dozen or so questions, so just to try and keep things on track instead of us meandering about. Why was this lawsuit filed, and why do you people at NARSAL not challenge the registry itself? If you get rid of the registry, this issue people have wasted so much time on will cease to exist, Larry. Why do you people not just challenge the registry itself?
Well, that has been done multiple times, with limited success, because registries may not be unconstitutional, and it depends on the registry. And in fact, Georgia's registry has been challenged, and they haven't made any dramatic changes to Georgia's registry in a decade since the federal case that was handled by Judge, I believe his name is Clarence Cooper. Are you oblivious to what's happening in the world with case decisions? We just got the decision out of the Tenth Circuit where it was vacated. Judge Mache was overturned by the Tenth Circuit. So if you want to continue to believe that the mere act of having registries is unconstitutional, you can do that. But it's not realistic. So the question is, why did NARSAL challenge the Halloween thing? We felt that, I can speak for NARSAL, we felt that if you've got 159 counties in Georgia and you allow sheriffs to invent requirements, this only happens once a year. But they can invent any requirements that's not in the statute and impose those requirements by their own initiative and then threaten to prosecute you if you don't comply. And we felt and still feel that we cannot allow law enforcement to invent requirements. We take that oath seriously when they put their hand on the Bible that they're going to enforce the law and not make the law. And that's why we attacked this. We felt that this was a clear infringement on a person's property rights, and it was compelling them to speak a message. And it was important enough to try to stop it in its tracks. So that's why we attacked this.
And without going down that whole rabbit trail of registries being constitutional, you have described what, at least from your point of view, will be like some sort of constitutional registry where maybe you have an app and you take a picture on your phone. There's your updated photo if that's what is necessary. But all of the restrictions, the term that you introduced me to is the disabilities and restraints, the living restrictions, the all of the other presence restrictions, all that stuff. That's what makes this so horrible.
That's correct. But each registry, each state, and even within the state, there's individual local restrictions that are imposed. And each registry scheme has to be challenged on whether it can withstand constitutional scrutiny. The mere act of registering someone is not unconstitutional.
What are the three claims that they, what were the three claims, and can we go through them?
Yes, we can. The defendants, the plaintiffs allege that the defendants, being the sheriff, compel speech in violation of the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, that they, the defendants, trespassed in violation of state law, and they committed an unlawful taking of the plaintiff's property in violation of the Fifth Amendment. And those were the three claims that they put forward. Didn't get a lot of traction on either of the three.
But they did award it to for one situation and not for the other two, I think is how we can say that.
Explain that.
They awarded it to the person that doesn't own the house. He doesn't have like the property interest. He lives with his parents, but not the ones that either own or rent their home.
Well, it's the opposite. The people who did not have there was lack of standing on the people who didn't own property. You can't take from a person what they don't own, and at the very minimum, they had to have a lease. And the people just living with their parents apparently just didn't have a lease, so they didn't really have any property rights as far as the court could see.
Okay. And if we move on, then it says this case was decided on motions for summary judgment. What in the flippity flip is summary judgment?
Well, it's an expedited process when you seek summary judgment. Either party can move, the defending party or the plaintiff. Either party can move for summary judgment, and when you make the motion, actually, I wrote an article for the Roush decision out of Tennessee, and we put it in our newsletter, and I cut and pasted it in here. I'm going to use it again. And the court itself explained the standard, but actually, I liked mine better. I liked what I'd cut from the Doe's versus Roush with my little add-ons in it. But summary judgment is a way to resolve a case without going to trial if there are no facts in dispute. And that's the key. The moving party is telling the court, we don't need to go to trial here. All the facts are clear. The parties are in agreement. Therefore, just decide the law. Decide the case based on the law. Save us a bunch of time and money, and we'll get this case over with.
Was the decision to request summary judgment wise in this case?
Well, being that I don't have a law license, I'll have to let the decision speak for itself. So in the summation that I've written, I've quoted from the court where the court said unequivocally that there were facts that were in dispute. And I highlighted that. It says, but the critical issue is, in fact, hotly disputed about whether the signs were on right of way or whether they were on private property. And that is not me saying that. I got it straight from the decision of the court. that
dig into that for just a minute?
Sure.
What is the right? I mean, like to me, I think of, you know, I'm responsible to cut my grass all the way to the street. I don't cut it all the way to 5 feet, six, whatever this is, some imaginary number is. However, there is a ditch, I guess, like a water runoff and an exposed drain, I guess you could call it. Am I not responsible to care for this part of the property because that's probably the city's?
Well, generally, you are required to care for that property. But the question is, can you as a private owner do, what can you do with that other than mowing the grass? Because you're not allowed to do certain things on easement and on right-of-way. But the government can. I mean, your speed limit signs are generally off to the side. You know, your any type of warning signage. I mean, utility easements. What happened in this case is that there wasn't sufficient factual development about what constituted private property and where these signs were being placed and whether they were being placed on right of way that the occupant and homeowner had no say so over, or whether they were being placed on their private property. That, in hindsight, should have been developed at trial. There should have been experts that talked about what the Georgia law is, and it may be individual county ordinances. I don't know all these things, but that's what you have a trial for, to bring in experts to talk about these things. And experts cost money. And it also would have delayed this case by another year, which would have meant the team that we have, they were faced with Halloween bearing down on us with no injunction, because the injunction from 2019 had expired. And we were arguing that it had expired to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, saying that there's no need for you to even hear this case because the injunction has expired. Therefore, they were going to have to request another injunction and go through that process, or could they go ahead and try to resolve the case on the merits in advance of Halloween 2020? And in hindsight, we can see that the decision wasn't favorable, but their analysis was that they thought they had it won. And you know, here we are sitting here quarterbacking on Monday.
I'm actually looking at the next question and wondering, going back to the previous listener, or a couple questions ago from the listener about, won't they just lay down? Couldn't we apply that to us? Hey, like, we've lost decisions. Should we just lay down and stop trying?
Absolutely not. I do not know what we will do, but I do know that NARSL has invested a significant amount of money, not gobs and gobs, but a significant amount of money. And we were committed to this case, and we believe in this case. So therefore, we're not likely just to go away and say that's the end of it. What we're going to do next, this just came out 3 days ago, so we don't know.
Can you like, literally, Larry, someone told me, like, you are the best legal strategist, legal mind that we know. And yes, I'm sorry to say, Larry, that you don't have all the fancy letters and Esquire and all that. You know, you didn't go to school for 100 years. I don't really care. The reason why our listeners are here and the reason why I chose you for this podcast was because of your expertise and your strategy and your insight and all that. So now that I'm done blowing smoke up your fanny, what do you see as the options to go next?
Well, the great thing is, even on summary judgment, there's a right to an appeal. Just because it was decided without a trial doesn't mean that there's no appellate review. So you would be arguing, and this is a great question, actually. This would get us back to Doe versus Smith versus Doe. The facts that
Alaska,
the parties,
right?
Yeah, the facts that the parties agreed to on summary judgment cannot change on appeal. Those are the facts. Whether they're facts or not doesn't matter. Those were the facts, and the appellate court will not disturb those facts, because that's what the parties agreed that they were. So, and anything that wasn't established as a fact is resolved in favor of the non-moving party on summary judgment. So anything, if the county says our defense would have shown this had we gone to trial, the appellate court has to accept that as being a fact, because they didn't ever get an opportunity, because we requested they not be afforded the opportunity to put on their defense. So we're limited in what can go what can be considered on appeal, because the facts were established by the parties. But that doesn't mean that the law was interpreted correctly. You know, there's cases cited all throughout the 28-page opinion, and those cases may be applied incorrectly. I don't begin to think that I know. I just prepared for the podcast today, did the best I could to put something together.
Yeah.
But what I would say is there's an appeal option. There's certainly the request for reconsideration before you go up on appeal. Then there's a notice of appeal to the 11th Circuit. There's already an appeal pending. And like I say, it could be extinguished, but there could be the possibility of combining these issues now on appeal with the 11th Circuit. But in terms of that, the team's going to have to huddle. The attorneys, there's two attorneys in Georgia. Janice Bellucci is working on this case with us. Yeah, I'm working on this case to the extent that anybody listens to me. And we've got to figure out what we can do. And I don't know all the things we'll do, but I know this, we're not going to just go away.
Okay. Is it possible that our cause has suffered a setback due to this decision?
There is absolutely no doubt that as of this moment, we have suffered a temporary setback. It may become a permanent setback if we lose on appeal, but clearly at this point, there will be adverse ramifications. There was the settlement negotiations at Spalding County. Those would be potentially adversely affected because Spalding County is in the Northern District of Georgia. This case is in the Central Middle District of Georgia, but it doesn't change the fact that the two counties border each other. And the county attorneys representing the two counties, I can assure you, are talking to each other. They're aware of this. And Spalding County is going to say, gee, I don't know why we should stipulate to a permanent injunction and pay these people money when the judge ruled against them. So that would put that settlement in jeopardy. The Georgia Sheriff's Association clearly has been informed and apprised of this decision. And they have probably already communicated to the sheriffs all over Georgia that this is a green light to go. Now, it was such short notice before Halloween. I don't know if their machinations being with COVID-19, if they actually could act on it for this year, but it certainly could impact us for next year. We all of a sudden could, rather than having butts in Spalding, we could have dozens or maybe 100 counties in Georgia doing this. So it's potentially devastating to us, which begs the question, it's not on the list. Why did you people litigate if you could make things worse? I mean, why didn't you just go home and forget the whole thing? We have that question come up all the time.
Just let the two counties, whatever, have to deal with it. And at least the other 157 counties didn't have to deal with it.
Well, that's exactly what we've got. A person in Clayton County that insists that Clayton County is very close to these counties, that we don't have it so bad here in Clayton County. And with you people making all this noise, first thing you know, we're going to have problems here in Clayton County. And you by people. by that standard, we should just never litigate anything. We should just turn a blind eye and say, well, it isn't so bad. It's only two counties right now. Of course, we had no assurance because we learned in discovery that the Sheriff's Association was encouraging these signs, producing these signs, and they were opining to the sheriffs that this was legal. So what we knew was that it had been encouraged by the Sheriff's Association. So just because only two were doing it at the time doesn't mean that was all it was going to all ever be. But now I'm afraid that there's going to be a rapid explosion of this because now they've got a green light. I mean, the court has said it's okay.
Can we walk down the path of compelled speech in regards to having a sign posted in your yard? The sign didn't say sex offender, PFR. It didn't use any of that language. It just said, "Don't get candy here."
We've got it here in the analysis. No trick or treat at this address. A community safety message from Butts County Sheriff Gary Locke, and it has two stop signs and a warning. The warning is the most problematic. Warning: Why is there a warning? On what basis? But that's all the sign said. It didn't say the person's on the registry,
right? So how is this so problematic? They're not calling the person out. I'm like, if we compared it to the driver's license that actually says, hey, you're a PFR, it's not the little innocuous thing in the corner that has some little code. This, I'm not saying that I certainly am not sitting here trying to say I agree with it. I'm just trying to be devil's advocate for just a minute. This doesn't say anything other than don't knock at this door.
Oh, that's so true.
How is this compelled speech, government message? Like, where do we cross the lines?
That's the struggle that the court had in terms of this case, because the government speaks all the time on documents. We've talked about the corrective lenses. Every state marks corrective lenses on people who can only pass the eye test with corrective lenses. That's not intended to shame you. It's not intended to do anything bad. It's intended to keep the public safe. If you require corrective lenses to operate a vehicle safely and an officer encounters you, that is the most innocuous way that I can think of to this very day to convey that information to the officer that if you're not wearing your corrective lenses, you're not safe to be on the road. That's all that's for. So that's government. That's the government speaking to the cop. And this changes slightly in my view because it is the government speaking to the passersby, but they're speaking on private from the platform of private property, and they're speaking on a day that that expression is accepted, that you can express yourself, and they're saying that you cannot interact with anybody that chooses to interact with you by this no trick or treating here. And it didn't say that you couldn't decorate, but I'm presuming that if the deputies brought the signs by and told you you can't hand out candy, they also told you don't bother decorate your house because that would encourage people to want to come. Yeah, well, I'm assuming that they did.
I don't know if it's for anybody on the registry or if it's just supervision.
But I'm making that assumption without any evidence. But I'm assuming they did that. So you're getting into some really significant areas of speech and expression that you're disallowing. But then again, let's take it to the cigarettes where we have compelled speech, because Sheriff Long says that clearly that his argument was that the government is speaking and no rational person would associate that this would be a message that the offender endorses. Therefore, we can do it. Clearly, it's a government message. Well, is it possible he's right? Since 1964, when you've bought a pack of cigarettes, there's been a variation of some form of warning. The first one started out with warning. The surgeon, I believe it said warning, cigarette smoking may be hazardous to your health. And then in about 1970 or 71, they came up with like a rotating message of like three or four different messages that said, warning, the Surgeon General has determined this. Do you think that the tobacco companies want that message on there? Do you think they endorse that? But isn't it the government commandeering their wrapper and forcing them to carry a message that they vehemently disagree with? How is it the government gets away with that?
And not only that, making them pay to put the message on there too.
And I'll take you one further. The government in the early 70s banned advertising on television. When's the last time you've seen a TV ad? Isn't that prohibition on First Amendment rights?
I guess if you think that corporations are people too.
Well, the Supreme Court said they are.
I know.
I mean, we don't execute very many corporations, but the Supreme Court said they are people.
So you wrote, in addition, most of the assertions raised in the complaint were dismissed with prejudice, meaning they cannot be raised again. Can you elaborate? Is this something similar to double jeopardy?
Yes, it's similar to double jeopardy. You don't get multiple bites at the apple when you raise claims that have been extinguished through a litigative process. So these people can't come back and raise these claims again. They had their chance. They had their day in court. They chose summary judgment. They're out of business now. Now, this is not a precedential decision. So it doesn't mean that new plaintiffs can't come raise these same issues, but it means these people, these claims are over. If they don't like these signs being erected, they need to vacate Butts County because they're done by and large, except for the one remaining claim, which I didn't completely understand, but there was one that was not fully extinguished by the court. And let's go back to the decision because it was at the very end of the order. And did I put it in my analysis? I think I did, didn't I? There's one. Okay, what is the surviving claim?
I thought the surviving claim was about the people that are living with their folks. I thought that was the surviving claim. The ones that don't, you know, somebody that owns or rents their property, that they are the ones that are doomed, and the ones that live with mom and dad, they're not on the lease.
Okay.
The ones that survive.
I know the section that says there's their hope. Yes, there is hope because the court was not able to resolve all issues, particularly the issue of whether the signs were on public right-of-way or private property. Quoting from the order, the court first makes clear that what it is not concluded The sheriff's office believes it has the right to post the signs in front of the plaintiff's homes as long as the signs are in a... I can't. You're a better reader than I am. Read that.
That's fine.
Sorry, with the sheriff's...
Yeah, the sheriff's office believes it has the right to post signs in front of the plaintiff's home as long as the signs are in yet-to-be-defined rights-of-way and that it can prosecute anyone who moves the signs. The court doesn't reach that issue, but as noted, the defendants have scant authority to support either proposition. And the court certainly doesn't conclude, given the facts here, that putting the sign in the plaintiff's yards makes sense. Rather, the court only concludes that, for the most part, the relief the plaintiffs seek is not available.
And that came from page 28 of the opinion. So the summary judgment precluded the court from being able to determine whether this is right of way or not. So that issue remains open. Any of the plaintiffs can bring that back again. But everything else is gone. They didn't trespass, and they didn't do a taking. And they do have qualified immunity because this was not a clearly the standard is that this has to be a something that's clearly established, these violations, alleged violations, and there's nothing clearly established on this, so therefore they have qualified immunity. But the remaining issue for these individuals is whether or not this is private property or government right of way. And the court seems to be telegraphing that they have scant authority so far for their assertion that this is right of way.
Didn't Janice Bellucci win a case similar to this in California, or is this a fig Newton of my imagination?
I think there was a case some years ago in Simi Valley. I don't remember the particulars, but I do remember that she, being on the team, that she had offered us that pleading, and I remember something along that line.
Then there is something to be said for 50 individual countries. You were just saying a few minutes ago about we have to fight each registry on its own home turf in each little state and all that stuff. So this goes to that as well, that she may have won a case out there, whatever the reasoning behind it was, and we fought a case here, different reasoning and different outcomes necessarily.
That is correct. And nothing that happened in California is binding in any way in Georgia.
But cookie cutter, copy paste, if it applies, then some of the work has been done for you already?
Correct, and you cite to it as persuasive authority, which this court cited to the cases. They cited to the recent decision out of Louisiana, in fact, when trying to analyze whether this was compelled speech.
How ironic. So the thing that we just talked about last week, was cited in this case.
It was. It was cited by the court, and they said the judge said he received an email about it. And he
That's
cited-
kind of funny.
He cited to the Marshall case out of Alabama in terms of the driver's license. But this compelled speech is really tricky, and I don't pretend to understand it completely. This is a nuance of law in terms of whether this is compelled speech or not, or whether this is government speech. And this certainly, the right-of-way is unclear to the court in terms of whether it was the right-of-way or whether it was private property. And what really wasn't raised in the complaint very succinctly was that the registry has its requirements, and a sheriff can't really invent requirements beyond what's in the statute, because therefore you get into void for vagueness. You don't know what you're required to do, and you can have a law enforcement officer, just because they have a badge, tell you have to do this because you're on the registry. No, it has to be in the statute. I think if I had anything to second guess myself about, I would have been more assertive about we have to figure out some way to have the claim in there that allowing the county to invent their own requirements makes the statute vague and void, because no one knows what they have to do. And we're getting ready to gear up again for Cobb County, because Cobb County is doing that very same thing. They're inventing requirements that are not in the statute, not in terms of Halloween science, but in terms of several other things that they're requiring. And they're arresting people for not doing those things. One of them is if you don't call them within 24 hours of them leaving a flyer, they believe that that's contemptuous of their authority. And they're locking people up and saying that they don't live there. If you don't call them back, they leave a few flyers. And then if you don't respond, they conclude that you're no longer there.
And I'm going to be, like, I don't know the right terms for this. You have described to me that there are certain areas of authority that different echelons have. I don't know if that's the right word to use, but the sheriff of the county is not something that's listed in the statute as being an entity? I hope I got you close enough that you can fill in the gaps.
Well, that was in terms of the Cobb County attorney's response to Narsil. Right. She said that in terms of the more frequent verification requirements, that these were imposed by Cobb County. And then she cited to the Adam Walsh Act that said that in the Adam Walsh Act, the language says that jurisdictions are allowed to exceed the requirements. And she's absolutely correct. Jurisdictions are allowed to go through the legislative process, and they can have requirements for registrants that are not recommended by the federal government to be substantially AWA compliant. But where her analysis broke down is that the Cobb County Sheriff's Office is not a jurisdiction. A jurisdiction is defined under Adam Walsh as being a state or a territory. So we pointed out to her that you're headed down the right path. The jurisdictions are allowed to do that, but they have to enact it through the statutory process. You can't, I mean, when you put your hand on that Bible, when you run for sheriff, you promise that you would enforce the law. If you want to be a lawmaker, Sheriff Long, run for the Georgia General Assembly and you can be a lawmaker. But right now, your job is simply to follow what's in that book. And there's nothing in the book that requires anybody to have signage.
And so a state or a territory would be Georgia or Puerto Rico. Those are the two entities that you just described.
Yes, and Georgia could conceivably put this in their statutory scheme that you're required to do this. Now, it's not recommended by the Adam Walsh Act. It would not get you closer to AWA compliance if you were in deficiency in some category. This wouldn't do anything because they don't care about Halloween restrictions. This would just make your citizens feel good, but this would not move you toward compliance. But you could do that. You can do things that are not recommended, and many states do, and that's where people misinterpret the Adam Walsh Act. And we need to do a program about the Adam Walsh Act one of these days because I get emails almost every week about it. And people so misunderstand the Adam Walsh Act, and they gripe about things that are not in the Adam Walsh Act. And I say, well, you gripe all you want to, but it's not there.
And I think out of all the other questions, I think this is really the last one. It says, both parties moved for summary judgment. This is something that I'm really trying hard to understand because this seems to be like the nuance of this whole thing is, did they move for the same summary judgment, both parties, or did they do this independently? Do they agree to a summary judgment? Okay.
No,
so they did one guy said they want this, the other guy said they want that.
Correct. The sheriff says,
both
we're entitled to summary judgment. Each motion for summary judgment gets considered independent of the other. So the court determines if the plaintiff is entitled to summary judgment and rules on that motion, then they determine if the defendant is entitled to summary judgment. But you could conceivably do a joint motion for summary judgment. But in this case, the sheriff had his reasons for wanting summary judgment, and we had our reasons for wanting summary judgment. And the sheriff had more compelling reasons than we did, so he won.
Okay, and you're just saying, as in, like, here's my list. So then the judge says, okay, you guys win because you submitted a better document, like copying and pasting.
Well, no, the law favors his interpretation of the law was that the case law supported the county's position.
Okay.
That based on what we argued, we were less compelling, and all the inferences were resolved in favor of the non-moving party on our motion, because anything that was not proven, the court has to interpret in the light most favorable to the non-moving party on a motion for summary judgment. So everything went in favor of the county on our motion, and everything went in favor of us on the county's motion.
Is it, do they, I guess they don't combine then. So then he just, the judge looks at it, and I keep saying he, because in this case, I don't mean to be like, you know, all judges are only guys. He looks at it and weighs which one he feels is better. Like, that's just the end of it? The guy with the robe? End of story?
Well, until there's an appeal. This is as if there had been a trial. This is if 42 witnesses have testified, and both sides have rested. And the judge made a decision. He made the decision on pleadings, and the rules established for summary judgment are that the non-moving party gets the benefit of the doubt on anything that's adverse to them, because they weren't able to defend that by the benefit of a trial. Back to the Smith versus Doe. Alaska said that we want this scheme because the recidivism is high. Since there was no trial and that was not able to be unpacked and the court below, the Supreme Court was bound to accept that because that was a defense that would have been tested had there been a trial. So they don't try the cases at the Supreme Court. And everybody does understand that the appellate court is not going to try the case.
And just one other point with this. If our side had said, we don't want summary judgment, does that negate the other side? If either side says they don't want summary judgment, does that mean everything then pushes forward? They both have to agree to the summary judgment?
No, you don't have to agree to summary judgment. You have to put forth reasons why summary judgment is not. You have to put forth, once the moving party shows that it believes it's entitled to a summary judgment, then you have to say, actually, there are factual stuff here that makes this case not right for summary judgment. You have to tell the court what facts are in dispute and why a trial is necessary. If no party tells the court that there's anything in dispute, the court is, well, okay, the parties agree on everything.
Okay.
So when we move for summary judgment, we told the court there was nothing factually that was in dispute.
Sure. And okay, so would we? I don't want to drag this out for forever. If we had said we dispute this thing, the judge could have still said, I'm awarding summary judgment?
Well, on our motion, we wouldn't have disputed anything because we made the motion. So we are telling the judge there's nothing in dispute. When they made their motion, we could have said, you should deny theirs because their facts are in dispute. We didn't do that either.
Okay.
So each party has to respond to the other party's motion.
Okay. That's kind of what I think that's what I was asking.
So, yes. And if they don't identify any material fact in dispute, the court assumes there are no facts in dispute. But the court eloquently stated in the opinion that there were facts that weren't facts, that there just wasn't enough there. We didn't have the facts in terms of what the right of way is. We didn't establish that.
I gotcha. I don't have anything else. We've been doing this for like 45 minutes. I think we are done beating this thing to death.
All right. Well, then do we have a dozen new patrons this week?
We did receive one new patron this week and want to send out a huge thank you to Eugene for becoming a new patron. Thank you so very much, Eugene.
Mr. The deputy HMFIC in chat has counted, and you have done three hands on the Bibles tonight. So if this were a drinking game, he would be under the table.
So he's got to learn how to pronounce Bible. It's Bible.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I think he's from up north, so there's no Bible. He just says Bible. Oh, my God. Larry, you have delivered us with crappy news yet again. Can't you ever be happy and bring us good news and be happy about the good news?
Well, I could be.
Larry, how can people find the podcast? Can we take a quick detour about that? There was a phone call that was received today about this podcast at, I'm just going to say, the wrong number.
Okay. And they left a message saying that they wanted a prisoner had submitted a question and it was answered, and the prisoner wanted his mother to hear the answer. And I immediately called the person back, and the person didn't answer the phone. And I tried multiple times throughout the day, and the person never answered their phone. And so I, for the life of me, I don't understand if you call and specifically say, would y'all call me back? And then you don't answer your phone. I don't understand how that works. How would you ever get the call back if you don't answer the phone?
They immediately went and took a very long hot bath.
For the entire day?
All day. All pruny fingers and all.
Well, see, I've lived long enough to where phones were the primary means of communication for most of my life. And now everybody has such a phone aversion. And when I survey people, I get various answers. But the one that I get most often is, I might have to deal with something I don't want to deal with. And I said, well, just press that little button that says end, and that'll end the call, and you won't have to deal with it anymore. And people tell me, well, I'm busy. I don't want to be a disruption. I said, well, just like anything else, just ignore it if you're busy. But don't just have a blanket policy that you never answer the phone. Because if you get an unwanted call, you can separate yourself from that unwanted call. And there are people who never, ever, ever answer their phone anymore. And
I don't ever answer my phone.
I know. I'm poking fun at you. I mean, there's people that never answer their phone anymore. They have all sorts of software and interceptors and everything that says the party's not receiving calls. And I don't understand. My family's that way, and neither of them work, and they say that they're afraid that they're going to have to deal with. So I said, what would you not be able to extricate yourself from? If the call is unwanted, just end the call. But they feel like they have to have permission to end the call. The only calls I don't like answering are the calls that come to the office of the senator, because I'm not allowed to end those calls. And therefore, when I'm in something I can't get out of, I prefer not to get into it. But on my personal phone, I can end any call at any time. So it's easier to me if I get, I've been called in last week. I've probably gotten a dozen calls about my warranty on my car is about to expire. And each time it comes from a different number. And each time when it starts, I just hit end and I'm done with it.
I don't know what to tell you, man. I don't answer any calls. That way I don't have to worry about all that.
So, well, but see, you told me that you texted the person back. How do you know
I did.
That phone received text? You texted them, but had they not responded, which I'm assuming they did respond, but if you didn't get a text back, how would you know that had been handled without talking to them?
Usually landlines will bounce back and say that this is a landline and can't receive text messages. Usually that happens.
Oh, okay. So you would have known.
I assume I would have known, but I took my measures. Plus, what you can't do on the phone, which, I mean, you can do, but it would require a lot of writing. Is I sent this person links to the podcast so that they could find where exactly to listen to it.
So, well, fantastic.
And they could just click on them in their phone.
So
the whole other reason that I brought this up to you was that we got criticized. God, this was forever ago, that we got too political and we started getting hate mail. Narsal started getting hate mail. So there's a disclaimer at the beginning of the program that says this is an independent program. Like, we are not part of them. Granted, we kind of cross paths very regularly. But now people are calling Narsal for questions to the podcast, which I find kind of ironic.
So, well, there is a lot of overlap because of, we operate from the same post office box. All the mail that's coming to the podcast, and we are getting mail now, is all coming to the same PO box, so it confuses people.
Well, all right. So people can find this at registrymatters.co. That is the website where to find all of the things. And, you know, were you to do some Google searching for the podcast, then you might show that might show up too. If you type in Registry Matters, you will definitely find the website. How about your favorite thing, Larry? Voicemail. Where do people call to get voicemail?
747-227-4477.
The email address is registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And if we don't get another patron this coming week, then I guess we'll just shut the whole thing down. And I'm poking fun. But, Larry, where do people support the podcast?
At patreon.com/registrymatters.
Fantastic. We love our patrons very much. They make this whole thing very worthwhile, and I appreciate each and every one of you very, very much, and all of our listeners. We had a crap ton of the YouTube people this week on last week's episode. Like, a whole lot.
Yeah, it's pushing 400.
Good grief, that's a lot. With all that, Larry, as usual, you are a master blaster of information about all things related to this issue, and we wouldn't be able to do it without you, and I appreciate it very much, and I hope you have the great rest of your weekend. You're going to go out and scare people and dress up as, I don't know, like Godzilla or something?
I am indeed.
Excellent. Thank you as always, Larry. I appreciate it very much. Have a great weekend.
Good night.
Bye.
You've been listening to FYP.